Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Robert McGinnis, we have here, Alliance of Evil. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's glad to be with you.
So, now, Bob, first of all, let's for the listeners that don't know you, who are you in brief, and kind of what's your history with politics and writing and things like that?
Okay. 18 years old, I went to the United States Military Academy at West Point, graduated 4 years later, spent a year on the demilitarized zone in Korea, came back, served in another infantry division, ended up in Europe, spent several years in the Iron Curtain, where they divided East and West Germany. I've been the chief for leadership at the infantry school, served in Alaska, served all over. Retired out of the Pentagon as an inspector general, worked at the Family Research Council as their vice president for policy for 9 years, came back to the Pentagon, where I continue to be. I was about an hour ago, and I run a team of international specialists. I happen to be one of the experts on security cooperation, so I work with armies all over the world. And my writing, I've been a columnist a couple of times. I have 5 books published, and of course I've done a lot of broadcast media over the years, and I'm speaking to you from Northern Virginia.
Well, we're glad to have you in L.A.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, let's see. And Kevin, you must be impressed going from McDonald's to...
Yes.
What is your biggest concern? Like, when you write books like Alliance of Evil, and you're talking in general really about a new type of Cold War, a new type of relationship that's going on between the major powers in the world, so like China, Russia, the United
right.
States. So when you write this, of course you don't know what you're writing until you write it. But going into it, what was your thinking process?
Well, keep in mind that I gave you a brief bio in which I participated in a couple of very tense locations, plus having traveled to China and the Soviet Union, I saw firsthand, you know, what the Cold War, the old Cold War, was all about. And, you know, people of my vintage recall, you know, ducking under school desks or being evacuated from schools, the so-called fallout shelters, and afraid we were going to become nuclear dust at any moment because of crises in Cuba or you name it. And it was a relief, I think, off of the consciences of millions of people around the world when the Soviet Union dissolves on the 25th of December 1991, and the hammer and sickle was lowered, and the Russian Federation under Boris Yeltsin was stood up. But unfortunately, I think we made some tragic mistakes, and as a direct result, the bear has reemerged under the likes of Vladimir Putin, who's just started his third term as president, and if he wanted to, he could probably be president for life. So I'm seeing a reemergence of a lot of indicators that I saw over a career in uniform and certainly over the last 25 years. And, of course, I've seen China close up and the same things, except China tends to be the long-term threat, whereas Russia is a short-term threat, but a very serious one.
When you say a series of mistakes during the Cold War, is that would the series of mistakes really be classified as perhaps something that we didn't take advantage of at the time? Is it a missed opportunity?
It was something we didn't take serious.
I think it is a missed opportunity. We could have done a heck of a lot more than we did. And, we could have brought them in to the Western fold and encouraged them much more. Bush had set Yeltsin down at Camp David and offered up some money just to kind of tie them over until they could get something working. But, we saw an opportunity to really transform that nation, and I think that we failed to. It was a black swan event, and we just, turned a blind eye when we could have changed an arch enemy into one of our best friends. And so today, they're incredibly suspicious of NATO. In fact, they asked to be join NATO, and we, of course, said no. They asked to do a host of things. So when they start to take over two provinces in Georgia, when they take over Crimea, when they, contest us, as they did this week in the Black Sea with Su-35s, or they do the same thing in the northern Atlantic. Admiral Richardson, who is the chief naval operations, said repeatedly over the last couple of months that, we're really in the fourth battle of the Atlantic. The first battle was World War One, second is World War Two. The third one was during the old Cold War, and this one with modern submarines, a growing fleet of Russian-capable, not only submarines but cruising vehicles. They're contesting the same territory. Why we didn't learn a long time ago to turn this thing off and help that nation to, join the West, I don't know. But we failed, and so we're paying a pretty high dividend as a direct result.
But quite honestly, Robert, though, at the time it seemed like they were willing to cooperate with us, but they weren't willing to cross a certain line. They wanted to keep their beliefs, they wanted to keep their culture, they wanted to keep their type of government, but we're willing to work with you, we'll shake hands on this, but we're keeping this over here. They were only willing to go so far. I really think that
Trump.
We put an earnest effort into it.
Yeah, well, no, you're right. It's because of trust. You can't all of a sudden go from arch enemies overnight to bosom buddies, and that's, why we had to do it incrementally. But we didn't have a strategy, a vision to help transform that very large country, which was armed to the teeth, and all of a sudden ran into some very serious financial and ideological problems, and help to nurture it in a direction that was favorable to us. Had we done that, I think that things would have turned out very differently. But that's hindsight, which is always 20/20. But, we face that. And let me juxtapose this, though. On the very day hammer and sickle was lowered in Moscow, the leader in China said, that war has ended. The war with us has just begun. In other words, the Chinese leader at the time looked to the United States and says, we are essentially at war with you. Now, we didn't recognize that, but if you begin to look over the subsequent decades, you begin to see not only their strategy, their political fodder, but also their behavior, and especially in the last 5 years, it's really been targeting everything that we do, not only the military stuff, but economically, ideologically, sociologically, you name it, they have been very aggressive. And that's why when I call it a dual Cold War, you know, it really is a dual Cold War. We have, because of our containment strategy, have foisted, you know, Moscow and Beijing into one another's arms. And, you know, we've just seen, you know, another meeting between Putin and Xi. We've seen their defense ministers meet almost every month. And the analysis by a whole host of people that are beginning to say, yeah, this does smell, look, and it really seems like a new Cold War. Even though, you know, admittedly, the chairman of Joint Chiefs, General Dunford, you know, said yesterday at Duke University in a speech, he said, you know, I really don't think this is a new Cold War. I think he's dead wrong because I don't think he's looking at all the indicators. But a lot of other people, yeah, all over the world, to include the Russians and the Chinese, are beginning to recognize that, yeah, this is something similar to what we've seen before.
How do we, but when you say contained, were you meaning things like containment for the U.S.? Do you mean kind of like the nationalist idea, you know, how Trump is operating his foreign affairs at this time? And to top that off, how is the Russian involvement in so many different parts of the American, you know, elections and all of this stuff, isn't that playing us again in a different way?
Oh, yeah, that's a subterfuge that Vladimir Putin, he's, you know, he's a former KGB. He understands how to do dark stuff, and he's incredibly effective at it. And he's got a lot of apparatus, you know, that are really working in a way that are causing, you know, us to have internal dissidence. He, you know, he hires these organizations, which I write about in Alliance of Evil, you know, the hacking groups. He puts some of his Spetsnaz, Special Forces people, into certain places to stir up the crowds. He trains people in from the West and sends them back to become involved in militias and the like. So there are a host of things that they're doing incredible. It's not the same type of confrontation I knew on the Fold the Gap on the Iron Curtain, where we were facing thousands of T-62 Russian tanks and BMPs and the like. No, it's far more subtle but very, very ingenious on their part, because they're using instruments of power, national power, in such a way that it's really frustrating for us to really focus. Now, that doesn't say they don't have a fairly sophisticated and they've taken advantage of all the technology that we have had and neglected over the years and have turned it on us. We've seen some phenomenal use of that in eastern Ukraine, and we've also seen some very impressive tests in Syria, whether they're cruise missiles or from ships or off of submarines. And, of course, they've continued to modernize their nuclear force, and that's in part why John Bolton was over there a week ago in Moscow, talking to his counterpart and saying, you know, we're not going to play your game. We're going to withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, the INF. And, oh, by the way, we're thinking about getting out of the New START Treaty, which comes up for expiration in another year and a half. So, I mean, it's all over the map. You know, Putin is a very, very smart guy. He, you know, back on the March the 1st of this year, he was doing the State of the Nation address, much like we have State of the Union. And he had, as a backdrop, these giant screens with all these simulations of modern weapons. And he said, yeah, you know, we can outdistance with hypersonic weapons, with fifth-generation fighters and this and that. We're doing just great. We're going to put the West on its toes. And, of course, that's rabble-rousing, but the fact is he is working on all of that, and that's public knowledge. And so Putin is just a very, very bright strategist that knows how to, you know, bend our ear. And, you know, he did find a bit of a confrontation there with Trump, because Trump, you know, he's not a pushover. He'll push back just like any tough guy, and Putin kind of respects that. So it's an interesting back and forth that we're beginning to see geopolitically between those two nations. And, of course, the same thing with Xi. Xi, of course, was enshrined as the president for life, thanks to the 19th Congress a year ago, and of course the Parliament, which is rubber stamp. They said you can be president for life, much like Mao Zedong, and all the thoughts of President Xi are going to be enshrined, and you know we're going to celebrate you. And of course, his China Dream, his Belt and Road Strategy initiative all over the world, they're beginning to pay off, and we're paying attention, finally.
Now, you've said a lot, and I'd like to back up and just give you an observation, just as you know the average Joe American. It seems like we were so busy making friends with Russia that they were very, very content to let us do that. You know, sure, I will take all the focus during this Cold War. Meanwhile, China is in the background working very, very quietly in the shadows. Now, in the last, like you said, the last couple of years, it seems to be a sudden flip. We're willing to let Russia get away with, like you said, you know, Georgia, the Crimea, you know, their involvement in other unspoken wars. Now suddenly wow, China, what the crap have you been doing in the background? Now we're beginning to discover all this. Was this by design?
Well, it was by default, I think, quite frankly. You know, after 9/11, you know, we took our eyes off of, you know, these big threats, and we focused on you know, the Middle East, specifically North Africa, Al-Qaeda, and eventually one thing morphed into another. We invented the war in Iraq, and then, of course, we've been engaged trying to civilize a 14th century country called Afghanistan, and we poured billions of dollars and a lot of blood in there. We still aren't out. Not that we're going to get out anytime soon, evidently. So, yes, we took our eyes off the ball. We became an irregular warfare type of modern military. That is radically different from the types of things that we're talking about that Russia and China have been developing. Where we stopped, and we stopped investing, and we wholeheartedly endorsed this so-called war on terror, then, meanwhile, the Russians began to get better. They still don't have a great economy, but they overinvested in military technologies because they had a lot of smart people that were still kicking around in the former Soviet Union that transferred into the arms industry, and those that stayed in Russia were back in business again. The Chinese did much the same. And, of course, they went to school on us. They've watched everything that we've done. You know, I mentioned General Dunford, in his speech the other day in Duke. And he said, look, they were so impressed, Russia and China, with how quickly we're able to organize and move forces and go to anywhere in the world. And so they went to school on us, and they've been able to develop technologies to counter absolutely everything that we have. And, of course, famously and rightly, President Trump has said, they steal on the order of $300 billion worth of intellectual property every year. And they do. And they're incredibly good because of their way in which they have organized their spy networks, their hacking networks. Even, people that come to the United States that they are still tethered to home back in China, they use these expatriates in a very unique way. And the FBI director has acknowledged this, the CIA director has acknowledged this. Mm-hmm. This is pretty common sense sorts of things. They've just been able to not only get well, but to begin to prosper in a way that has been to our detriment. All the while, we were captivated by these little wars in the Middle East while these giants are beginning to emerge in a way that really has us on the ropes.
You know, now let's tie this into prophecy, because if I'm understanding your philosophy, these things have to happen. And I've heard a lot of eschatologists or people who study prophecy mention Gog and Magog. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it really depends upon how you read, the prophecy and interpret it. You know, I have a friend by the name of Norm Heiser, and he studies and reads ancient literature. And he's also a theologian. And you know, he cautions us not to really believe that God encrypted the scriptures that we have today in such a way as to really precisely point out modern countries. So in other words, there are a lot of people who will read, say, Ezekiel 38 and 39 or Revelation 12 and 16 and other scriptures and say, ah, that's China or that's Russia. Well, we don't know for certain. All we know is that in the context in which these scriptures were written, they were talking about a threat. And I believe that there will be a threat that will be profiled much as it says in scripture. I just don't know that it's necessarily China and Russia. Now, you mentioned Gog and Magog. Well, if you go into that particular scripture, it suggests it's a nation to the north, Magog.
Yes.
Gog is the leader. And, well, I would argue, a good friend of mine was a year ago this month, was down in Cairo, and he was meeting with General Sisi, President Sisi. By the way, Sisi is a graduate of the War College where I teach. And Sisi was telling my general friend, he said, Erdogan, of course, the president of Turkey today, he wants to be the caliph, and he wants to establish the Muslim caliphate. You heard all about what ISIS wanted to do. Well, this is President Sisi to a very reliable friend of mine, and I have no doubt that this is what happened. Now, if you follow what Erdogan has been doing over the last years, you begin to say, that might make some sense. Here, everybody's been talking about this Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered by the 16 henchmen sent up from Riyadh, whether they were sent up by MBS or whatever, I don't know. Probably. That's a guess. However, Erdogan's been playing this like a Stradivarius, because it's a competition against Riyadh and him, who's going to take over the Sunni world. Erdogan, he's been dedicating mosques in various places. He was just up in Cologne, Germany. What did he do? He visited with Angela Merkel, but he also dedicated a giant mosque, the largest one in all of Germany. Now, that seems to be atypical of a true politician, but he's not. He's not a true politician. He's a mixture. And, of course, he does have an ambition not only to be the caliph, but he wants to fulfill this by 2023. Why? Because the modern Turkey under Ataturk was formed in 1923. And so he has this ambition that he's going to have this grandiose power base by that time. Now, I say all that because Turkey is due north of Israel. Mm-hmm. It is quite possible that Turkey is Gog or Magog, and that either Erdogan or a descendant of Erdogan, a future caliph that follows him, could be Gog. But we really don't know. You can interpret it in various and sundry ways. Others say it's a nation north of the Black Sea. Of course, that would be either Ukraine, which is really the breadbasket of Russia, or modern Russia, Moscow. A lot of people come to that conclusion. What's not in doubt is that something's going to come out of the north and is going to be problematic. And the other one, of course, is in Revelation. It talks about these armies coming from the east and, this giant 200 million man army. And everybody thinks,
yes.
Well, certainly any country that has a billion point three like China, they could generate a 200 million man army. Well, China's army is large, but it's only a few million. It's certainly not 200 million. So I'm not sure how to interpret that. Plus, the fact is that this army supposedly crosses over the Euphrates just north of Baghdad, apparently along the old Silk Road and the of course, it describes in the scripture that it's going to be a dry-bedded Euphrates. Now, I've been to the Euphrates, right north of Baghdad. So it's a real river, and it's described as, you know, basically much like the Red Sea was parted before the as Moses led the people of Israel across, escaping from the Egyptian Pharaoh. Well, this army of 200 million allegedly is going to cross over north of Baghdad and on the dry riverbed of the Euphrates. Don't know. It sounds interesting why a modern army of that size would even consider marching from downtown Beijing all the way to downtown Jerusalem. I don't know. I've been in those deserts. It's not a pleasant place. But, you know, that's the nature yep. of what we're dealing with. So there's a lot of speculation. You know, you could. There's an interesting statement by Alexander Dugin, who's a Russian philosopher, and also a bosom buddy of Vladimir Putin. And he also happens to have some interesting views. And he's written about his good friend Putin, and he calls him the Eastern Orthodox Tsar. And he says that he is leading a war against the Antichrist. And what he cites is a term out of 2 Thessalonians 2:6 and 7. And the term in Greek, it's katechon. It's interpreted as basically one who withholds. And so if you read the 2 Thessalonians 2 verse, it says, "For the mystery of lawlessness is already working." And what apparently Alexander Dugin refers to as Putin at war against the Antichrist is that the Antichrist is the secularized West, which I find a fascinating concept, because apparently in the propaganda that, you know, keeps Putin a rather popular nationalist in his country is the fact that, you know, he's standing up for motherhood, apple pie, and, you know, the greatness of the Russian people, and they like that. And of course, we're the boogeyman in the West, and, you know, our moral decadence, and they get to point it out, and the people say, yeah, this guy's our savior. And, you know, it's not, you know, unknown that he is referred to by certain clerics over there as the Russian savior. So you've got all these issues that are brewing here when we talk about not only biblical prophecy, but modern-day interpretation of those prophecies.
Boy, you just give me a lot to consider. Let me process this for just a second.
Okay.
Now, what is their opinion? When you talk, you know, to people on that side of the aisle, what is their opinion of what you just said? What is their opinion of the prophecy, since it seems to be, you know, pointing directly at them?
Well, some of their clerics actually believe that we're at the end times. You know, they really do. And, you know.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm no, you know, diviner of the future necessarily, but certainly if you take Ezekiel 38, if you take Revelation 16, you take some of the others, scriptures in mind, you can make a case that yes, we're rapidly moving toward cognitive dissonance as a world. We up seems to be down and down seems to be up, and a guy that is saying that he knows the direction to take his country, like Putin and like Xi, that's why authoritarians, when there's a lot of confusion and there's an attack on self-confidence, they seem to thrive. We've seen this historically. You saw it under Adolf Hitler after World War I. He was disgusted with what was going on, and he stood up the Third Reich, and he was incredibly popular. He led to some pretty harsh results, but we've seen this with the likes of Napoleon. We saw it with Alexander the Great. We've just seen it throughout the ages. So you've got certain people that are very influential, and I think, certainly Putin is very influential in his country, and he has the allegiance of those people, and President Xi seems to have the allegiance of, certainly the 50 million communists that are part of the Communist Party of China.
So one last question from me, then I promise I'll shut up for a little while because you've got me so intrigued. Why is it, though, that we seem – okay, let's switch it over from Russia to China now, because China has been all over the news with its style of censorship and how they're having seminars, teaching American companies how to censor us much like them. Is this all part of the plan? I mean – now, I know it's going to sound like a stupid question, but have we been suckered by sending a lot of our business over to China? Now they have it. They're teaching them a certain methodology and then sending it back, and we're swallowing certain philosophies.
Oh, yeah. We're incredibly naive as a country. When Kissinger, first went over there and he ushered in Nixon, and they made happy and glad with the likes of Chou Enlai, and as a result, we started this great relationship that led to basically us trusting them and them robbing us blind of all our goodies. Our companies go over there and they're suckered into these Chinese programs that they have to compromise their intellectual property, and they do it left and right. Otherwise, they won't be able to make a dime over there. And they've done this through the years. Now, what they're doing now, and I mentioned this earlier, the Belt and Road Initiative, which was started in 2013 by President Xi, it's a great idea. It's all about building infrastructure, but really behind the veil, it's all about developing leverage, geopolitical leverage across the world, in order for them to stipulate to you know, countries that become beholden to them because they've built a road or a stadium or, you know, electric system or whatever, that you either, we're going to call your debt, or you do what we say you're going to do. And oh, by the way, in a lot of the ports, like Sri Lanka's port or the Suez or Panama Canal, and, you know, there's 68 countries involved at this point in 900 different projects. If you have access to these facilities, the PLA, People's Liberation Army, Navy, they're there. And they're using these facilities for their own nefarious purposes. So, and it's not just that. They're trying to persuade countries to turn over their internet programs to them. Now, you know what they've done with Google, or trying to do, and you know that, you know, they peer under the skirts of absolutely every piece of intellectual internet connections in China itself. Well, by building their own infrastructure on these countries that are beholden to them, then they get these leaders in those countries to cooperate with them. You know, what was it today? I was looking at how a lot of information that's on certain networks is funneled through servers in China, in these large Chinese corporations, and of course they're filtered before they're routed back to the country in which they were intended to go to. A technique, yes, but a very dangerous technique, because they sift out information that they're interested in. And they've been very, very smart about it. And of course they have an army of hackers. They have a new organization they just stood up 2 years ago that oversees cyber and space, electronic warfare, and maybe one other area. And it's kind of outside the military chain of command. It works directly for the senior leaders. And it's sort of like the NSA and CIA and a couple of other agencies kind of, you know, morphed together to do the types of things and the bidding that the leadership over there wants to do. And they're doing a great job for China.
Hmm. So how do you see the relationship with Saudi Arabia? And how do you see that, and how it's going to affect this three-way Cold War?
Well, the Saudis, of course, because they're in OPEC and they really control OPEC, the Saudis are, most of their attention is drawn across the Persian Gulf at Tehran. The love-hate relationship that dates back to, you know, Muhammad's great-grandson, and that's when the split was, and they just hate one another. And they'll continue to hate one another. And so that's why we have the conflict in Yemen. You know, the Houthis are fueled by, you know, the Ayatollah and his Quds force, and they give them rockets to attack the Saudis and, of course, to kill, you know, the poor Yemenis. And, of course, the Saudis, who have our equipment, and we train them, but they don't pay attention in class, so they go over and they drop bombs, but they miss a lot of times and they kill innocent people. And so you have that civil war that's, what, it's lost 10,000 people, and millions of people are facing starvation. And, of course, you know, Congressman out there, Smith, and I think rightly, is beginning to say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be helping those Saudis to, you know, go in and kill so many Yemenis. Well, whatever. That's mostly about Riyadh versus Tehran. Then, of course, you see what's going on in Damascus. And, of course, you have Iranian Quds force. You have Iranian regulars that are fueling that civil war. They've got a foothold there. And, of course, they have their proxies, Hezbollah, in south of the Litani River and north of the Israeli border. That will continue to build up, and before long we'll probably have the third battle between Israel and Hezbollah. We've already seen a lot of drone attacks, and the Israelis, of course, have been striking as many of the Iranians as they can, and, you know, they've upset the Russians because, you know, what was it, a month ago, Israel was over there attacking one of the Iranian facilities, and they drew Syrian fire from, what was it? It was one of the surface-to-air missile systems, 202 mm-hmm. or whatever. And they shot down a Russian reconnaissance plane instead of a F-16 that the Israelis were flying. And, of course, the Russian Prime Minister, Medvedev, or was it Lavrov, one of them, called down and, really yelled at Netanyahu and said, look, you set this guy up, set the Syrians up to fire, and you knew that they wouldn't be able to hit your jets, but they hit one of our slow-moving reconnaissance aircraft, so that's bad sort of thing. Well, it's a messy battlefield there, and so you have that is sort of a proxy war because the Saudis are fueling the Arab dissidents, and of course Erdogan has his own beef there against the Kurds, and they don't want a modern Kurdistan. Of course, you can blame us for that because we promised the Kurds at the end of World War I we were going to help them unify and have their own country, and we've reneged on that in spades. So you have all of that mixed-up battlefield, but it's really between Iran and the Saudis. And, of course, the Saudis have good friends and the Pakistanis who they bought off, and they probably have some of the nasty weapons that the PAKs have been using. So that's of some concern, I think, geopolitically to us. So you really have a Sunni-Shia war by proxy that's going to probably continue for some good long time. Now, the Saudis, they'll use their oil wealth. I know Mohammed Salman is trying to modernize that country. It doesn't help that he uses his thugs to murder people, if that's the case, but he wants to, allegedly allow women to drive, so that's what he's known for here recently, and he also wants to build modern cities on the west coast of the Arabian Peninsula. He wants to, find new businesses that can employ his mostly underemployed population that have been dependent upon the government lagerists because of the oil wealth. But at one point, that's going to dry up, and all he'll be left with is a bunch of sand and salt water. And so hopefully for his benefit, or at least his predecessor, they can figure out what to do.
Well, and hopefully not a nuclear bomb.
No.
Well, money buys a lot of things in the world. And, keep in mind, Pakistan has, by the unclassified sources, maybe 200. Do you not think that the Pakistanis, who we can't trust anyway, and are now becoming the bosom buddies of Vladimir Putin, they just were doing some exercises there in Pakistan, and, of course, they continue to provide harbor to the Haqqani network and, of course, al-Qaeda in the mountains there. Do you not think that they would sell something? How do you think Mr. Khan, who was really the father of the modern Pakistani nuclear weapon, he worked in the Netherlands, learned the technology of enrichment. The Chinese sold him a plan, and they kind of cobbled together their own little weapon system, and they've been testing these things, and I think that there's really nothing that would keep them from selling to their best buddies over in Riyadh a weapon system. So that's a real possibility and something we're concerned about. At some points we the United States have considered going in there and seizing their weapons to make sure they're safe because we were concerned about some of these terrorists organizations going in and taking over some of these facilities. We're not even sure they have what we call permissive access links. I used to work with nuclear weapons a little bit, and there are these, basically it's a padlock, a very special type of padlock that keeps just anybody from coming off the street and blowing up a nuclear weapon. So we're not even sure they have that. So that's of a geopolitical national security concern with the PAKs, who we're no longer best friends with, but they are best friends with MBS and the likes of King Solomon.
So at the end of the day, what do you think is best for us to do? What's best to happen? And did this election help any?
Well, it helped the stock market today. The stock market did great. You know, I think we should have election every day if it's going to do this well. you know, I think I happen to like what Trump's administration has done in terms of a national security strategy, national defense strategy. I think it's a clear-headed approach that considers economics part of national security. It considers the cyber part of national security. It considers people that pull triggers on weapons national security. So it's a broader definition as to what is our national security interest. I don't want us to go to war. The last people that want to go shoot at people and get killed are soldiers who actually know something about what they're talking about. And so what we need to do is to be strong enough so that the likes of Vladimir Putin and Xi don't come after us. Now, in spite of some of the issues that perhaps and the criticism Mr. Trump has had with his dealings with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, at least this young man has not been blowing up nuclear weapons in his tunnels or firing these errant missiles over the last year. He stopped doing that when we started to engage with him. And there's a good chance that we can entice him to put away those nasty things and to join the rest of civilization. Well, I think we need to be obviously more nuanced when it comes to Putin. I do believe that Trump's meeting with Putin in Helsinki in July, he didn't announce a lot of what he said, except that he did talk about nuclear weapons, and I know both of them are concerned about that. But I think that there is hope that we can get along with the Russians, but we have to be smarter about it. The sanctions are really bothering them, and I understand that. And of course, they're targeted sanctions, much like what we're doing with the Iranians. But we're also sanctioning the Chinese. The Chinese are going to, like I say, they're going to be more ideological and more of a threat very long term. Russia, I think, will, we can bring them into a very different orbit. But President Xi and his very ambitious global views are going to be far more of a challenge. So we have to be, and I think Trump is right in terms of economics, we need to level the playing field here. And in spite of their rhetoric over Beijing, we are beginning to see some accommodation there. So that's going to help our economy, and it will help to kind of smooth things elsewhere. But they are also very hegemonic. Look what they've done in the South China Sea, 3,400 acres of islands. They put airfields and ports and cruise missiles and the like. So they're expanding out. I think, I can see 50 years from now they're going to have a much broader grasp of an influence around the world than they currently have. And, we can either learn to live with that and recognize that they're a peer competitor. That does not necessarily mean that we have to be adversaries, shaking our weapons at one another. But we have to be smart about it because it's not going to be easy.
Well, that being said, what do you think of the election? Actually, just a quick note on that, and anything? Do you see anything positive coming out of it?
Well, I saw a lot of things positive coming out of it. One, we're still a country. We didn't fall apart as a direct result of being divided politically. And I find that good news. I've been in other countries around the world where, you would have such divisions within the population that things resorted to blows and even worse. So, we've lived through another election, a rather contentious one. But you know, now we have a divided government, and apparently Wall Street was excited about it with a 500-plus increase. Yeah, you know, I think that with a slim majority, the Democrats in the House will have to, because they don't have an iron grip on every single one of their own party. There's going to have to be some modicum of cooperation. I think infrastructure cooperation. I think that, you know, we got to deal with health care. We need to deal with a number of other rather significant issues. I certainly, as somebody that works in the Pentagon every day, I'm concerned about the Budget Control Act of 2010, because we had a compromise a couple years ago that kind of, you know, pushed back all the ugliness that can come when you stop and, you know, the spending levels. We are recovering our readiness after Mr. Obama, in my estimation, you know, neglected a lot of our systems. And of course, the threats are very, very real, as I've pointed out or tried to over the last few minutes with you. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to deal with that. I hope that by being strong, we won't have to have a repeat of past wars. And I think that there's a possibility that the Democrats and Republicans can put aside their ugly words and somehow collaborate together on a brighter future. So, and I think that it's going to be easier for Mr. Trump now that he has a little more than, you know, a split Senate. He has a couple extra votes, so he'll probably be able to get some of the people that are waiting in the aisles to be confirmed so he can fill a lot of the positions that he would like to fill.
Amen to that. Let me just amend something that you were saying and bring two points together. You know, I'm very relieved to see that we are rebuilding our military. We're starting to get our tech industry involved again and rebuild some of our defenses, while at the same time, like you said, North Korea at this point seems to be playing ball with us and, you know, reducing their nuclear capability so far. You know, by all appearances, how sustainable do you think that that is, though, given the fact that our government is changing and the way that we do things is changing?
Well, Kim Jong-un, I think, is a rational player. I don't think he is a crazy guy. I think that he is getting his direction from President Xi in Beijing, and there's plenty of evidence that every time he gets a message from Washington, he either phones or goes and visits President Xi and says,
"Oh,
okay,
agreed."
Asking his mentor what he ought to do. And so Xi is the ultimate manipulator behind the scene here. Kim Jong-un's just the puppet. However, I think that, you know, if we can provide a good enough package of guarantees, he just wants his regime to survive. Xi wants us out of Korea. We have 28,500 of our soldiers there, a lot of our weapons. They'd love to see us out. And, you know, of course, the South Korean, President Moon wants us out too, given his politics, but he knows he needs to keep us there, at least for right now, because of the threat. So I think that if we continue with Mike Pompeo meeting with his counterpart and, you know, President Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un, and we may, with enough goodies in the offering, begin to, you know, really ratchet down the tension. We've already agreed military to military to, kind of tear down a lot of these facilities, guard towers that I used to know many years ago over there. We're canceling exercises. So we're kind of slowly beginning to soften, you know, what's going on there, with an eye, though, on, you know, what their real behavior is, because we obviously don't want to do it too quickly, so it endangers not only South Korea, but endangers Japan, which is nervous about this, and, of course, our longer-term interest. It's nice to be able to kind of look over the Sea of Japan and look over at the Chinese on the other side of the Korean Sea, and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of anticipate what they may be doing and keep them wary of what we're doing there.
Well, Well, we are running out of time quickly. We want to thank you for being on the show, and we'd love to do it again. Your book, yeah. Alliance of Evil, will be posted on our website, as well as we have a page up there for yourself, for guests that we've had, and your information. So if people want to get a hold of you, one click.
Great. I appreciate that.
Well, our guest has been Robert Majanis. Thank you very much for being here.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.